You're listening to the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. North Carolina's agricultural industry contributes $70 billion annually to the state's economy. Many of the farms that grow corn, soybeans, and sweet potatoes are right here in the East. But have you ever thought about how most local produce is harvested from the fields before it's delivered to the stores? Director of Outreach for Greene County Healthcare, Steve Davis, has been working with migrant farm workers for 16 years.
Duplin County, Wayne County, Wilson County, Lenoir County, and Pitt County would be some of the more densely, more populated areas as far as the migrant farm workers.
North Carolina ranks fifth in the nation for its number of migrant farm workers, and Eastern North Carolina has the highest concentration in the state. Many of the farm workers in this region are coming from Mexico and other Latin American countries. They are contracted to work in America on a H-2A visa, which allows them to stay in our country for up to a year.
And those workers are usually brought here on buses to Bass, North Carolina, where the North Carolina Growers Association is located at. And then they're processed, through the system and then distributed throughout the state, depending on what grower they're going to be going to work with.
Migrant farm worker labor allows us to enjoy fresh produce year-round. However, they are some of the lowest-paid, least-protected workers in the country and are often exposed to dangerous work environments and substandard living conditions.
Agriculture only works in North Carolina with migrant and seasonal farm workers.
Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Wake Forest University, Dr. Thomas Arkery.
Without them, many of the crops that we have would rot on the vine. Many of them would never be planted.
Dr. Arkery has studied the health of migrant farm workers for almost two decades. His department at Wake Forest University studied farm worker camps in 16 eastern North Carolina counties. It found drinking water at about a third of them failed to meet current health standards and posed a risk to farm workers and surrounding communities.
61 of the 181 camps, that's about a third, 34% to be exact. There were total coliform present, and in two of those 31, there were E. coli present, which indicates that the water is not pure or clean and that it is unsafe to drink.
The community-based participatory approach to farm worker housing, exposures, and health study did not determine if farm workers became sick from drinking that contaminated water. Rather, Dr. Arkery says the purpose was to determine the quality of farm worker housing and how it may be related to health. While Dr. Arkery was conducting research on site, he says the majority of the farm worker camps his team visited had unsanitary and unsafe conditions.
There was rust and not working kitchen facilities. There was trash strewn about. There were holes in the roofs. There were holes in the walls. There were no locks on the doors. The bathroom facilities did not provide privacy. That is to say, there were some places where there might be six toilets in a row with no dividers between them. There were six shower heads in a row or more with no privacy screens between them.
Dr. Arkery believes the North Carolina Department of Labor's lack standards for farm worker housing and lack of annual inspections could be the reason why many of the camps in eastern North Carolina fail to meet state quality requirements. The findings from the study were presented to the Department of Labor, but Dr. Arkery doesn't think any changes will happen.
Commissioner Berry, as well as some of her staff members, acknowledged that we had done a competent and actually high-quality study, but it did not appear that they would be doing any more inspections.
In compliance with the Migrant Housing Act, the Department of Labor conducts inspections at camps prior to occupancy. In addition, the Bureau performs inspections of housing based on complaints and referrals. According to the Bureau Chief for the Agricultural Safety and Health Bureau, Regina Cullen, it's the local health department's responsibility to make sure the water is safe to drink.
Sometimes, absolutely, there are problems with the water. Sometimes growers have dug new wells. Sometimes they've chlorinated the water supply. If we are getting a call in the middle of the season saying, hey, there's a camp out here, they've got contaminated water, we refer that to the local health department and they'll go out and check.
Cullen says the North Carolina Department of Labor works closely with county health departments to test the water at farm worker camps. She adds, if fecal material is found in the water supply, the North Carolina Department of Labor is required to relocate those farm workers. In the study by Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, coliform bacteria, which is an indicator of human and animal waste, as well as disease-carrying germs, was present in some of the water samples from camps in eastern North Carolina. Dr. Arcuri could not release the names of the camps where E. coli was found. Next week, we hear the second part of this two-part series, which will focus on the responsibility farmers have to provide free housing to migrant farm workers.
Good afternoon. You're listening to PRE, Public Radio East, and more specifically, the Down East Journal, the program for Eastern North Carolina, about Eastern North Carolina. I'm Kelly Batchelor here with the program producer, Jared Brumbaugh.
You know, your pledge makes the stories that you hear on Down East Journal possible. It's quick and easy to pledge. You can pledge online at publicradioeast.org. You know, and the general rule of thumb is that for every minute of feature material you hear on air, it takes approximately 1 hour of production, from getting the interviews to writing the story to fact-checking to producing the feature from start to finish. It's a very lengthy process. That story we just heard talking about the migrant farm workers in Eastern North Carolina, the different camps in Eastern North Carolina, and that study, that's a piece that's 3 weeks in the making. So it takes a lot of time to put these information-packed features together. And it also takes your pledge. It takes you doing your part when you make that pledge online at publicradioeast.org or by calling 1-800-222-9832.
You know, it takes money to make this Public Radio East business work. Yes, we are a not-for-profit service, but we're also a business. We have people we have to pay for that feature work. We have local reporters. Yes, they have hourly wages and salaries, so we have upkeep that we have to do on our studios. It's hard finding a studio space here at Public Radio East, but that's good. That means we have more local reports coming out to you. We're constantly trying to improve this radio service and make it as local as possible. And I think the Down East Journal is one of the cornerstone programs here at Public Radio East. We're asking you to make your pledge of support to realize that we can't cover these stories about Eastern North Carolina without your donations. I made my donation. Have you made yours? Membership is annual. So what we're asking for you to do right now is go to publicradioeast.org, where we have a secure online form. It takes a couple of minutes to fill out, and you'll be done. You can use your MasterCard or Visa, or you can do a bank draft, or you can write us a check and send us your donation. Just within the last couple of months, Jared, I've been so impressed with the amount of local features that we've had, uniquely Eastern North Carolina news features on Down East Journal. We talked to officials with Naval Hospital Camp Lejeune about the treatment and interventional services they provide to Marines and sailors returning from combat, a big issue nationwide. We brought it down to the local level. We also focused on Cape Lookout National Seashore. They had a public comment period recently on ways to facilitate ferry service to Shackelford Banks and the Lighthouse. So we looked at how that project could potentially impact Down East. We love shining the light on Eastern North Carolina issues, and we do that through member support. It takes money, but it's affordable when everyone does their part. And I enjoy the Down East Journal. I know you do, too. Make your pledge of support. It couldn't be easier.
It really couldn't be easier. Make that pledge online at publicradioeast.org. Kelly, you're exactly right. We've been hard at work all year bringing you the news and features and conversations that you've relied on when you listen to the Down East Journal. I was actually tallying it up this week, and I can say that since last fall, since this time last year, the Down East Journal has aired over 120 new local feature reports. Now, I can't even begin to estimate how many hours and minutes that adds up to, but I can tell you that's a lot. I just want to say thank you to everyone who's made a pledge to Public Radio East, because your pledge makes it possible for us to be able to bring you those stories from around our region. Right now, make a pledge at publicradioeast.org or call us at 1-800-222-9832, and you will be ensuring that we are able to continue to bring you the best local news possible. You're listening to the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. One was a commissioned U.S. Navy officer and later a hero of the Confederacy. The other, born into slavery, who bought his way to freedom not once, but three times. The lives of those featured in the new book, Two Captains from Carolina, could not have been more different, but the book's authors said they had remarkable similarities as well, at least in one realm. George Olson has more.
On the one hand, the stories of Moses Grandy and John Maffitt share much in common.
The thing that these men share is a tremendous tremendous devotion and at times single-mindedness to the overarching craft of how to work well on the water.
And on the other hand,
their fates could hardly have differed more.
Bland Simpson, the author of Two Captains from Carolina, which weaves the stories of these two men together in one book. Together may be too strong a word. At no point in their lives did they ever meet or speak, their only commonality being a shared North Carolina heritage and a life on the water. And in the pre-Civil War period, no commonality would likely have been allowed, as Maffitt was a white man in the employ of the U.S. Navy, and Grandy, for much of his life, a slave in the employ of whoever had bought his services. Those contrasts are reflected in how these two men came to decisions about adopting a sailor's life. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains from Carolina about the tail end of an adventure aboard the USS Constitution, which locked in Maffitt, the son of a well-known pastor, though raised by his uncle, a Cumberland County doctor, to a life on the sea.
Again, heavy weather bedeviled the Constitution. Is one great storm not enough, mused Maffitt? Must we be spared by a late winter nor'easter, only to be shipwrecked now by a springtime English gale? Commodore Elliott mustered every seagoing talent he could bring to bear in threading the needle between ocean rocks and the waves breaking upon the Scilly Islands, pushing through at 9 knots, mainmast twisting and groaning, and a general fear among those aboard ship that she would be dismasted in the night and they would all be lost. Yet they were not. Old Bruin kept up speed and brought them through and then cried out the general order, once all danger was past, splice the main brace. Everyone, including John Maffitt and his young comrades, gathered about the grog barrel, where it was rye for one and rye for all, and the huzzas rang out, and a jolly lot they were again. This is adventure. This is the life, Maffitt reckoned, the one true life for me.
That contrasts with how Moses Grandy viewed his life on the water, initially a chore given him by his masters, but which allowed the slave Grandy some hint of freedom. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains from Carolina.
Wintertime, wartime, he cared not. In a life and in a world of captivity, he was at last master of something important, his own movements for many days at a time. Cold? What was that? Start early. Start while it was still dark and the hard winter cold had its rough grip upon all these broad, low tidelands, when the moon hung in the night clouds and the Black River seemed frozen to its edges. This was still a cold he could live with somehow. Raise those two heavy Bermuda sails and catch the bare breath of wind and move slowly away to the north in this Cypress freight boat past the cypress sentinels lining the river's edge, some faintly lit by the setting moon, some silhouetted, and Grandy and his crew, guarded by the very trees, moved upriver like free men. The work may be hard, exposure to the elements may be severe at times, it was, heat and insects at one time of year, and cold and ice, and you know, winter rain and so forth, and another time of year. Still, these men were operating on their own. These black men were operating these boats around the sounds and up the canals and so forth. It's also a very subversive sort of thing to be in a slave culture, to be able to act essentially for much of one's time as a free man. That feeds that fire.
That fire fed Grandy enough that he worked hard to purchase his freedom, and not just once but ultimately 3 times, his first two owners cheating him of his purchase and selling him before his final owner was true to his word. That fire also led Grandy, once ensconced in the Northeast, to purchase the freedom of family members and into the abolitionist cause, a cause that could be seen as a change in his focus. Maffitt likewise saw change in his sailor's career. Prior to the Civil War's eruption, he resigned his naval commission and offered his services to the Confederacy, though perhaps without the fire that led Grandy to abolitionism.
The Lincoln people do not court him to stay in the Federal Navy, and then when he finds out they're going to arrest him, he just gives up, goes south, and he almost doesn't stick with Jeff Davis. He's appalled at what he hears Jeff Davis and Stephen Mallory say. They don't think there's going to be a war. They don't think the Navy is all that important. He sees very quickly that there's just not a strong guiding intelligence behind this Confederate leadership. So he almost leaves. If Robert Toombs had not come after him after Maffitt first met with Jeff Davis, Maffitt would have left. They would have gone to Europe somewhere, probably to England.
Despite his lack of faith in the Confederacy's leadership, Maffitt ultimately became perhaps its greatest naval hero, operating as a blockade runner. But the fire of the Confederacy never really burned in him. His one fire throughout his lifetime was stoked by that early adventure on the Constitution and the months and years on board ship that followed.
He said, even though he had a farm on the mainland there near Wrightsboro, near Wilmington, he said, a waterman, a man of the sea, is not fit for much else. So as far as evolution, I think he felt like that's what he was, and that's what he always had been. He was born at sea.
And what he remained even after the Civil War. He captained a British merchant vessel for 2 years, then returned to the U.S. and his Wilmington farm, where his maritime work continued. He married for a final time and wrote an autobiography. He died in 1886 and was buried in Wilmington. And there again the contrast with fellow sailor Moses Grandy, who could not return to his native Carolina, who traveled in 1843 to speak at an anti-slavery conference in England, then returned to Boston, where his last documented sighting was at a publisher's office, and then nothing. No evidence of his life or death past that event can be found. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains.
No one would ever know when Moses Grandy lay down for the last time, or what his last words were before he was laid to rest, neither the when nor the where of it. In his life's work, he was first and foremost a sailor, a supplicant depending upon the motions and mercies of wind and water, which still and always abide. From a Pasquotank River ferry flat and the freight boats on the old Dismal Swamp Canal, to the lumber schooners in circuit around the Albemarle Sound, to the blue water ships that took him to the old wine-dark Mediterranean Sea, and then around the world, to the East Indies. He was a mariner, and he did what mariners do. Mark it down for all time. Read it as the epitaph for a great man born in Camden County, North Carolina, who lies somewhere in an unmarked grave, its whereabouts known only to the mind of God. Captain Moses Grandy, he sailed.
In lies both markedly similar and dissimilar, those final two words of an imaginary epitaph for Moses Grandy work as well for John Maffitt. Bland Simpson is the author of Two Captains from Carolina, Moses Grandy, John Newland Maffitt, and the Coming of the Civil War, published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm George Olson.
You're listening to the Downeast Journal on PRE, Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh, joined in the studio this afternoon with Stephen O'Connell. He's one of our reporters that you hear often on the Downeast Journal. He's done stories about growing high-energy grasses to make biofuel. He also did a feature on the water contamination issue at Camp Lejeune. That's an issue that's been affecting that area for many years. That's the kind of information, that's the kind of stories that you hear on the Downeast Journal. Isn't it worth your pledge of support right now to ensure access to those kinds of news stories? Make your pledge at publicradioeast.org. It's a quick and easy process.
Just go to publicradioeast.org, and on the right side of the website, you'll see Make a Pledge. Help us bring that local news to you. Me, Jared, and George Olson, and LC, we're all reporters trying to bring Eastern North Carolina news to everyone that listens.
Not only are you ensuring access for yourself, you're ensuring access to Downeast Journal for everyone else in Eastern North Carolina. You know, we're always looking for ways we can grow. And last year, we ended up expanding the show to fit more local news in. And that's a great thing, but now we would like to make it even longer. We want to expand it out to an entire half hour. But to do that, we would need more local reporters to cover the stories that you want to hear. So for the Downeast Journal to grow, it takes you coming on board with your financial support and making your pledge this afternoon at publicradioeast.org. You know, we've been hard at work. And Stephen, you know, we have aired over 120 new features focusing on news and events happening right here locally.
We were traveling. We were talking to people from all around North Carolina. We stay late. We're writing our copy for hours. We spend time editing and re-editing our stuff to make sure we're getting the truth to you. We go the extra mile on the Downeast Journal. You've depended on us, and now we're depending on you to help us take care of these costs. Go online. It's very simple. It's very easy. Just go to publicradioeast.org. And on the right side of the website, you'll see Make a Pledge.
And of course, you can also make your pledge at 1-800-222-9832. Once you've made your pledge, your membership is annual here at Public Radio East, and you can sit back, listen to a Down East Journal, enjoy the shows, enjoy all the programs here at Public Radio East, knowing that you've done your part to support it. Make your pledge right now at publicradioeast.org, and thank you so much.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. You know, it's always garlic time in my kitchen because I use garlic, gosh, at least 4 times a week in my cooking, I'm sure, and I use lots of it. And luckily, I'm still cutting off big, beautiful cloves from last year's garlic harvest. Well, I say last year. I mean, it was the garlic I harvested early summer of this year. But because right now is garlic planting time, I'm already into a new garlic year. The garlic lasts a long time in the kitchen. I'll be using the garlic I harvested this summer for months and months to come. I have a big, beautiful braid of it hanging from my pantry door. But this week, I planted new garlic. And oh, what fun it is. I don't know why, but garlic is more fun than almost any other plant to plant and harvest. I guess because you don't just use it every once in a while by itself, but you include it in so much of what you do in the kitchen, and it makes it feel so important. Sort of like the little red peppers that I'm still harvesting and drying and grinding to use all year long. Garlic and peppers, two great items you can grow and save and use for a long time. But let's get back to the garlic. So, to plant garlic in your home garden in coastal North Carolina, you just need to buy garlic bulbs from a garden center or mail order company. The soft neck varieties work better here in the South, so I recommend them. Break the clove apart, or break the head apart, I should say, into individual cloves, and then plant those cloves between 1 and 2 inches deep, about 4 to 6 inches apart in the garden. Make sure they have plenty of moisture and plenty of fertilizer to get started, and plenty of moisture throughout the winter. They will come up. You'll see green sprouts before winter gets here, and then they'll really take off and start growing in the spring, when you'll need to fertilize them some more. You'll harvest them when the tops start to dry, and when, if you knock the top over, it doesn't stand back up again. But that's something to talk about another day. For now, you still have a couple more weeks to plant garlic if you haven't found any yet. You can do it in just a small portion of your garden, but remember, it's going to take up that soil until early to midsummer, so put it in a place where you didn't want to plant spring peas. Think about how much garlic you use in the kitchen, or if you're not using it now, think about how wonderful it would be to start adding it to your own fresh pasta sauces and stir fries. And go out and buy a big head of garlic for planting. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
You're listening to the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. We're in the midst of our fall fun drive, and we're asking you to make your pledge of support right now. You can pledge online at publicradioeast.org. Your pledge makes a difference in bringing you programs that you love, programs that you rely on here at Public Radio East.
And I know a lot of people in Eastern North Carolina are really excited about renewable energy. And we just did a feature in the last few weeks about the biofuels industry in Eastern North Carolina, particularly in Sampson County. We talked to researchers and farmers about the potential of growing high energy grasses that could be converted into ethanol. We'll continue to bring you renewable energy stories from around Eastern North Carolina. It's very exciting for us. I know you're glad to hear this information. We also looked at the life and legacy of Ava Gardner just last week. A heritage tour was held in her hometown of Smithfield. That actually propelled me to go to that. Yeah. How many times have you been somewhere that you've heard about it first on Public Radio East, Down East Journal? We love being able to highlight Eastern North Carolina places and stories and history. We do that with your pledge of support. You send in your donation, and we pump out local news for you. And this program is all about Eastern North Carolina, and it's for you in Eastern North Carolina. We're glad that you love to listen to it, but certainly make a pledge of support to keep it on the air.
And it's supported by Eastern North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Listeners like you stepping up to the plate, making pledges at publicradioeast.org. Kelly, in the last year or last few years, Public Radio East has faced funding shortfalls, $66,000 in state funding. And
That's a total elimination of state funding.
Total elimination in state funding, as well as $90,000 in federal funding cuts. Now, you would think with all the budget cuts that local programming like the Down East Journal would start backpedaling, but actually we are stronger than we have ever been before. You know, we are producing more features. We've had to expand the show to accommodate all the extra news production and work that we're doing here. And we want to continue to grow. We want to continue to provide that local news coverage for this region.
In this global media market, I think it's more important than ever that your public radio station, Public Radio East, become as local as possible. Of course, we're always going to bring you the international and national news, but local news is important too, and your pledge goes to support that right here.
Make that pledge online at publicradioeast.org. And thank you so much